First of all, I would like to thank the organizers for the invitation to give this talk here. It's really a great conference, very diverse, and I enjoyed it very much. This is one of the my talk is one of the few talks which brings up superconducting qubits, and for this reason, and also following advice from the organizers, I will have two relatively long introductory parts. So I will start with the first part, in which I will explain briefly how superconducting circuits behave as artificial atoms, and I will discuss in a bit more detail the properties of one particular type of superconducting qubit, namely the flux qubit. In the second part of the talk, I will describe briefly how we do quantum computing with superconducting qubits, so I'll go through some of the methods we can use there. And I will also go quickly through this topic, quantum optics in the strong coupling regime, which is interesting in its own, but I'll bring it up mainly because this is something we use in our experiments, in particular in our work on quantum computing. Then I will present our actual work, which is the implementation of a new type of two-qubit gate. This work was motivated by one specific problem we had with our qubits. It turns out that we have a coupling between the qubits which does not allow the implementation of let's say, an easy two-qubit gate at the point where coherence is optimal. And we had to deal with this problem, and we came up with a new idea to implement this two-qubit gate by using what you may call control transition matrix elements. So this is a gate based on resonant driving. As it turns out, we actually do not need much to make this gate work, and this is also a strong advantage. So in fact, we do not need much more than what we already need for the implementation of single-qubit gates. So I will present this idea, the first experimental implementation, and also some work in progress we do on an extension of this. And in the final part of the talk, I will comment on the application of this type of gate to other types of physical systems. So just to get started, if you are to devise a classification of different systems used in quantum computing, you may do it depending on your taste in the following way. When you look at superconducting qubits, this is in a class that you may call artificial systems. The main point of interest here is that this is a top-down approach to quantum system design, and we hope that in the long term this will become an advantage when we are to think seriously about quantum computing and scaling up. And this is how a superconducting qubit looks like. So what you can see here is an atomic force microscope picture of one device that we make. So the flat green region here is simply the surface of a silicon wafer, and on top of that we evaporate two thin superconducting layers. The actual qubit is this superconducting loop here. One essential element in this are the Josephson junctions. So the Josephson junctions are overlap regions between the two superconducting films that you can see here. You can also see the scale, the sizes here, which are typically 1 micron, and if you look at the thickness of the layers, this is typically 100 nanometers. So how does this system work? How does it work as a qubit? So obviously we need superconductivity, and from superconductivity we use first of all the property of no dissipation of energy, which is something you obviously need if you want to have coherent systems. Then something else which is essential and which comes into the description of superconducting qubits is the fact that when you look at the superconducting state, an important fraction of electrons, and this is actually the fraction of electrons which take part in electronic transport, gets grouped into Cooper pairs. Another feature of superconductivity is that for energies below a certain minimum value, which is the superconducting gap, you cannot excite the superconductor. And once you do that, you actually have dissipation coming in. So in order to have superconducting qubits, you have to do something clever, which is to build a set of lower energy excitations. Those low energy excitations are obtained if you bring in Josephson junctions. And I will show to you that you can do that, and the energy scales coming into that are the Josephson energy and the charging energy. So A Joston junction is a structure as drawn here. So you have two superconductors separated by a thin tunnel barrier. Each superconductor has a number of Cooper pairs, so you can take these numbers to be N1 and N2. So if you take the two superconductors and pull them apart, the ground state is given by this state with N1 and N2 Cooper pairs. But then you can form other quantum states by taking a number n, lowercase n, of Cooper pairs and moving those from one side of the barrier to the other. So it turns out that this is a quantum coherence. So this transfer of Cooper pairs is a quantum coherent process. This is the main discovery of Josephson. And you can write down an effective Hamiltonian for this Josephson junction, which has this surprisingly simple form shown here. So you have hopping terms between states with different numbers of Cooper pairs. And you have a term in front, which depends on the property of the junction, and which has dimensions of energy, and this is the Josephson energy. So now, if you look at the system, it's straightforward to determine the energy eigenvalues and energy eigenstates. So these energy eigenvalues are parameterized by a phase, gamma, and are given by this simple relation. So E of gamma is minus Cj cosine of gamma. And the energy eigenstates parameterized by gamma are simple superpositions of states with different end values and with proper phase factors. So a Josephson junction can sustain a dissipationless current, and this can be seen simply if you form a wave packet around some value of gamma. It turns out that for that wave packet, the current is given by this simple relation, so it's proportional to sine of gamma. And the proportionality constant in front is what you call the critical current, and this is proportional to the Josephson energy I introduced earlier. And if you take this so-called supercurrent channel, you can show this as an electrical circuit element, which is simply a cross. So this is how usually draw Josephson junctions. Now there's just one more thing you need to take into account to fully describe a Josephson junction. When Cooper pairs move from one side of the barrier to the other, there is an additional contribution to the energy, which is simply electrostatic energy. This has the following form here. And if you write the charge as being the charge of a Cooper pair, 2e times the number of Cooper pairs n, you have another energy scale coming in, which is 2e squared divided by 2c, and this is the charging energy. And this is actually all you need to make a superconducting qubit work. So you can take now the simplest system you could imagine, which is just the Josephson junction that I introduced earlier. You can draw this, and we like to do this, you can draw this as an electrical circuit formed by the supercurrent channel and the associated capacitance of the junction. This is a proper quantum system. It has two operators, a phase gamma and the number of Cooper pairs n. And you can write the Hamiltonian in the following way here. So if you take this part, which is the Josephson energy, this is simply a cosine. And then you can calculate the energy levels if you want, and this is a representation of the energy level. So this is a properly defined quantum system. One essential property which already comes in is the fact that the energy level structure is anharmonic, and this is something essential if you want to use the system as a qubit. The other essential point is that when you look at the energy level structure and in general quantum properties, these are a function not only of fundamental constants, such as the flux quantum and the charge of a Cooper pair, but also of the so-called mesoscopic constants, which are parameters that we can change at will. So this is what makes this become artificial quantum systems. Okay, so let's go back to our qubit, which is, as I mentioned earlier, a flux qubit. So here, if we want to calculate its properties, we can simply proceed in the following way. We write a circuit diagram. We identify the important contributions to the energy of the system. So we have a part which is the electrostatic energy, which acts as kinetic energy, and another part which is which contains both the Josephson energy and the magnetic energy. And it turns out that you can write down this. If you take the Josephson energy, you can write it down as a function of only of two of these variables. So I'll not go through all the details here. The important point is that. You have two sets of parameters here, so you have Josephson and charging energies for the different junctions, and then you have one control knob for the qubit, which is the magnetic flux applied to this ring. So this is something you just apply with a coil. Yes?
Can you describe the superconductor in terms of Cooper pairs, a microscopic model?
Yeah.
If I imagine that circuit that you drew,
Yeah. No, it doesn't, and it in fact you can still use that as useful circuit, but in that case it's just a harmonic oscillator and it has an harmonic level structure. So you can still do things with it, but it's not a qubit. We actually do use that kind of element in for other things, and I will show one of those. Okay, so the quantum properties depend on the applied magnetic flux, and if you can calculate it, it actually turns out that it's relatively straightforward to calculate quantum properties. So this is a plot of the energy levels as a function of the applied magnetic flux. As you can see, this qubit is very anharmonic, which is a feature we like for quantum manipulation. The typical energy level spacing is in the gigahertz range, so in the low microwave range. We identify the qubit as being the projection to these two lowest energy eigenstates. So if we zoom into that region, this is a plot of the energy level diagram for the qubit. This is the effective Hamiltonian of the qubit, where again I highlighted in orange the so-called design parameters. So these are things that we choose at the time of where we fabricate the device, and then we have the control parameter, which is the magnetic flux. This is now represented in a basis formed by two states in which the current in the qubit loop flows either clockwise or anti-clockwise. And one other useful representation of this is that if we look at the potential energy, which is a function of two variables, we can identify two minima. And when we take a cross section through this line here, where the two minima are. You can see that these two minima correspond actually to well-defined values of the phase and hence to well-defined values of the current. And these two values are opposite in sign. So the effective picture at the end is these two well potential picture. Just to explain some of the methods we use in quantum computing with superconducting qubits, why not go quickly through the DiVincenzo criteria? So I already showed that you have something that can behave like a qubit, so you have a proper quantum system. This is criterion one. Then you need qubit state initialization, and qubit state initialization is done the simplest you can imagine. You just take the qubit and you put it inside the cryostat. This is relatively special, but it's relatively routine technology now. And if you reach these temperatures, you can cool down the qubit to the ground state with a probability which can relatively easily be matrix in 99%. Then you need a universal set of quantum gates, and you need two qubit gates, and C0 is sufficient for this purpose. I will not say anything here about how you make a C0 gate, because actually this is the purpose of our work, so I'll describe that in the main part of the talk. As far as single qubit gates are concerned, we use simple resonant manipulation. So this is exactly what is done in NMR, for example. We take the qubit, it has this Hamiltonian, which is diagonalized here, and then you drive it with a single frequency tone, and when this frequency omega matches the energy level splitting, you have a resonant population transfer. And if you can change the time of the pulse and the amplitude, or the amplitude and then also this phase, you can actually implement any type of unitary operation you want. Now, what about decoherence? So decoherence is of course the main challenge in quantum computing, and this is for superconducting qubits. This is an extremely complicated story. Let me just give you one. Let me just bring up one experiment here. So this is a measurement on a flux qubit done recently at MIT, where a relaxation time of 12 microseconds was measured, and spin echo dephasing time of 24 microseconds was measured as well. So now these are pretty good coherence times when you think of the fact that the Larmor time of the qubit. Yes, please. So you will see that later in the talk, but the time can be as short as 10 nanoseconds. Right? Oh no, it can be more than 100, up to 1,000. So yeah. So this is a very good device, and this is actually the best coherence time ever obtained for a flux qubit. There are many open questions here. So reproducibility is an issue. Unfortunately, not all the samples have this kind of coherence time, and we also don't understand the microscopic origin of energy relaxation. The other problem is that in all these devices there is intrinsic low frequency noise, and this low frequency noise shows up as a magnetic flux that you cannot control, and this leads to dephasing of the qubit. And in fact, these results here were obtained in the best possible case at a noise insensitive point, and I will explain this in more detail a bit later. And now just to mention quickly a quantum measurement, this can be done with very high fidelity. It's not a straightforward task, and as it turns out in many experiments, it's not entirely trivial to do good measurement and good state manipulation at the same time. But there are now many implementations in which the readout fidelity can be higher than 90%, and the projectiveness of the measurement can also be quite high. But I will not say more than this here. Let me bring up one last element we need, which is the following type of system. So we can take a superconducting qubit, in this case a flux qubit, and put it in interaction with the Fabry-Perot resonator. The Fabry-Perot resonator here is a bit more special. So what you see here, so these brown lines, you can think of this structure as being a one-dimensional waveguide for light. And then you can think of these two discontinuities here as being effective mirrors for microwaves. So this is a Fabry-Perot resonator for microwaves. This system is described using the James Cummings Hamiltonian, which is fundamental in quantum optics. So you have this Fabry-Perot resonator characterized by which is a bosonic mode with resonance frequency omega res and the creation and annihilation operators A Degger and A are given here. Then you have the qubit Hamiltonian, and then you have the interaction between the two systems of strength G. The strong coupling regime is the regime where the strength of the interaction is much larger than the decay rate of all of the cavity and of the qubit. This allows you to study interesting physics. So when you are on resonance, you can observe a very interesting phenomenon, which is the coherent exchange of population between the qubit and the cavity. So this was the holy grail of the field known as cavity quantum electrodynamics. Another interesting thing you can do with this system is when you take the qubit and have it off resonance with the cavity. So in this regime where the detuning, so here I'm using, I'm not very consistent with notation, so this would be the detuning between the qubit and the cavity. So when this detuning is much larger than the coupling strength, you can write a Hamiltonian which contains the product between the qubit operator and the number of photons in the cavity. So this provides a way to do measurement of the qubit. And it's interesting because it's a very generic way which is applicable to many types of qubits. So now this type of system was studied in quantum optics for a very long time, and there it comes under the name of cavity quantum electrodynamics. In our field, it comes under this slightly different name, circuit quantum electrodynamics. And the reason we look at this is first of all, because fundamentally, this enables us to look at the quantum properties of radiation in a domain of frequency very different of optics. So it allows us to get a handle on the quantum properties of light at these frequencies. And also, it is possible to achieve much larger coupling strength in using this system than in optics. And this leads to qualitatively new phenomena. So let me now move to the main part of the talk. The problem we dealt with was the implementation of a two-qubit gate for two flux qubits. This is a picture of the device. So what you see here is the circuit overall is relatively complicated, but you can focus on these two outline loops here, which are qubit one and qubit two. So these are two flux qubits, and they are simply placed close to each other in order to make them interact. So physically, how this interaction goes is as follows. Say you take qubit 1, this qubit generates a magnetic flux which depends on its quantum state. And this magnetic flux is picked up by qubit 2, which results in a change of the Hamiltonian of this qubit. So now, formally, you can write this down in the following way. So the interaction Hamiltonian is this term here proportional to J and containing sigma x1 and sigma x2 for the two qubits. The single qubit Hamiltonians are given by the following expression. So you have a sigma z term, which is proportional to the delta 1 coefficient, and this is fixed in the experiments. And then you have a sigma x term, which is proportional to an epsilon coefficient, and this is something that can be tuned in our experiment. So here I changed notation, so I swapped x and z, which is just a change of basis compared to what I had in the introduction. And so when you look at the orders of magnitude for these coefficients, J is typically smaller than delta 1 and delta 2, but in fact can be made comparable to these two coefficients. And epsilon, as I said, is fully tunable. And epsilon is, in fact, proportional simply to the magnetic flux. So if you take the energy level diagram that I showed earlier, this flux axis is something that you can simply relabel as being the epsilon axis, with the center here being zero. So how do you do a two-qubit gate in this system? It's simple to think first of the case in which epsilon is much larger than delta for both qubits. So again, this is the Hamiltonian. Epsilon much larger than delta means that you are somewhere far from this symmetry point here. So when you are in that situation, the Hamiltonian can be written like this. So you have three terms. The interaction term commutes with a single qubit term, so it's very simple to write down the energy levels. So you take the two qubits, color-coded in blue and red, respectively. The energy levels are epsilon 1 and epsilon 2, respectively. So when you bring the two qubits together, but you forget about the interaction, the energy levels are given by these dashed lines. And when you switch on the interaction, so when you make J positive, the intermediate levels are pushed down and the extreme levels are pushed up. So now, if you take this transition frequency here between state 1,0 and state 1,1, you can see that this is different of the transition frequency between 0,0 and 0,1. So that means that if you share radiation on this transition, you can have a flip of the qubit 2 if qubit 1 was in state 1. And this is exactly what you need in order to implement a C0 gate. But now, there is a problem with this. So if you look again at the energy level diagram, you see that the energy level difference is insensitive to magnetic flux at this symmetry point here. And in fact, this is the point where you have the best coherence properties of the qubit, because as I mentioned earlier, there are intrinsic magnetic flux fluctuations in these devices. And in order to have the best coherence, you should rather stay at this point here, where the energy level splitting is only sensitive in second order to these fluctuations. This is also so for atomic physicists. This is also what you may call a clock transition. And this was proven in many experiments, and I'm just going to show some data from experiments at NEC. So you can see here a plot the black dots are the relaxation time of the qubit as a function of this bias. You can see that actually it's relaxation rate, not relaxation time. So this relaxation rate does not change much as you change the magnetic flux around the symmetry point. But when you look at the dephasing rate, so these are the empty dots here, the dephasing rate actually blows up as soon as you move even a tiny bit away from the symmetry point. So it's, in order to have the best coherence properties, you really have to stay at this symmetry point. And when you do that, the two-qubit Hamiltonian is as follows. So you have, again, the single qubit terms and then the interaction term. But now the interaction term is XX, whereas the single qubit terms are ZZ. So when you take the energy levels of the combined system, the non-interacting two-qubit system would, again, have levels given by the dashed lines. Now, turning on the interaction leads to level repulsion, so the two intermediate levels are moved opposite to each other, and the same happens to the extreme, so the lowest and the highest level to some extent. And now you have a problem. So when you look at this energy level splitting between 1,0 and 1,1, and there is a tilde here on all the states because these are not simple product states anymore. There is some mixing coming in. So when you look at this energy level splitting, this is the same as this one. So now you cannot use frequency selection anymore to implement a C0 gate. And the way out of this is if you think a bit more closely about what you can do with the two drives you have available for the two qubits. So our system looks like this. So you have the two superconducting qubits, which are two loops with sizes of few microns. They are placed close to each other. And it is possible. So these qubits are driven with superconducting lines that can be brought very, very close to the qubits themselves. So these are fabricated on the same chip where the qubits are. So if you take now, if you think of putting a current through this line here, you generate a magnetic flux, and this flux can be made to couple mostly to this qubit, but not to this other qubit. And this can be controlled despite the fact that the distance between the qubits is much smaller than the wavelength of the radiation. So the wavelength of this radiation, the microwave range, is a few millimeters. But since we work with microwaves, it's pretty easy to control near fields, which vary appreciably on the scale of the qubits. So thinking about this, you can write again the Hamiltonian of the two qubits, and now you also include the two driving terms. And the two driving terms are have the same frequency. This is not even a constraint, because in fact the two drives can be completely independent. But what you change, in fact, is the amplitude. So you have different driving amplitudes on the two qubits, and you also have different phases of the microwave you bring in. And you can now calculate the matrix elements for transition induced by these two driving fields that you apply at the same time. So you take a microwave frequency which corresponds to the transition between the level IJ and KL. So here IJ and KL are 0 and 1, corresponding to the two qubit states. If you go to a proper rotating frame, you can write the transition matrix element in this way. So what you have to take into account is an operator which contains terms of the form A times exponential of I phi, so A and phi again, so these are just the driving amplitude and phase, and you have the sigma x operators. And to understand how this works, let's look at the case where J, the coupling, is much smaller than the detuning between the two qubits. This actually works in general, but it's just simpler to see in this case. So the energy eigenstates of the two-qubit system are given by the following expressions here. So the 0, 0, and 1 states are only weakly perturbed by the coupling J. But when you look at the intermediate states, there is some. These states are superpositions. So, for example, if you take the state which was originally 0, 1, this acquires some admixture of 1, 0. There's only a weak proportion of that, so J divided by the difference between the deltas, but this is enough to do the trick. So, if you look now at the transition matrix elements from 0, 0 to 0, 1, you see that if you take the ratio of, so if you take these two phases to be equal and the ratio of these two driving amplitudes A1 and A2 to be given by J divided by the difference of the deltas, you can actually cancel this transition matrix element. And when you do that, this other transition matrix elements so when you go from 1,0 to 1,1 is still non-vanishing. And you can use this to implement a CNOT gate. So the way you do this goes as follows. So this is what we done in the experiment. So the experiments were done at Delft University of Technology. So I was not involved directly in these experiments, but more in discussing these ideas and experimental design. So what you do is you start with the first pulse shown here in blue, which prepares. So when you start from the ground state, this pulse prepares the first qubit in a superposition of states 0 and 1. After this pulse, you have a superposition of this and this state. And if you now shine radiation corresponding to this red transition, then both of these transitions should run at the same time. This can be seen in experiments. So if you measure the state of qubit 2, you see that there are oscillations. And in order to extract those frequencies, we do a Fourier transform of the oscillation. And this is what is shown on this graph here. So if you take a slice this way, you see that you have two oscillation frequencies. And if we now change the difference between the phases of the two microwave drives that you apply to the qubits, then you see that for one specific point, one of the two oscillation frequencies is cancelled. So at that point, you actually completely this transition between 0,0 and 0,1 vanishes, and you only have the transition between 1,0 and 1,1, which still survives. And this can be seen now if you look at the plot of the population of QB2 as a function of tau1 and tau2. So these are the times of the first and the second pulse. You see that it's only when qubit 1 is prepared in state 1 that you have an oscillation of the qubit 2. Whereas when qubit 1 is prepared in state 0, there is no oscillation taking place. Now, how fast is this gate? And this is a question which came up earlier, and this is, of course, very important for quantum computing, because if the decoherence time is a given, which it usually is, you need to do the best you can with your gates. So when you look at this scheme here, the speed of the gate is limited by an off resonance effect, which has to do with this transition. So what we will have is this transition on. This transition is suppressed with this condition on the drive amplitudes. But this transition, even though off resonance, can still cause some damage if the Rabi frequency is large enough. And it's particularly damaging when the Rabi frequency becomes comparable to the detuning between the two qubits. And when you put all the numbers in, it comes out that this gate cannot be faster than J, the strength of the coupling between the two qubits. And this is, of course, something you expect when you think of the fact that the amplitude of that coupling is J. Let me now also say something about some previous work that was done on this subject. So this need for a two-qubit gate when you have transverse coupling, so by transverse coupling I mean you have a coupling term of the form XX, was of course considered before because this problem with coherence and having some magic points for coherence was there all the time. One solution that was proposed was parametric modulation. So the idea here is that you have again a coupling term which is J sigma X sigma X, and you modulate in time the amplitude of J. And when that modulation is done at a frequency which corresponds to the difference in the transition frequencies of the two qubits, you can have a swap between these intermediate levels 1,0 and 0,1. Another way to do it is the flick fork scheme. So this is more complicated, and it relies on a more subtle mixing effect. So the idea here is that you drive each qubit independently, and when you drive them strongly enough that the Rabi frequencies for the two qubits add up to be equal to the difference in transition frequencies, then you can again obtain an entangling gate for two qubits. More recently, this flick force scheme was generalized to a scheme where it actually becomes pretty similar to what we do. There is still a major, there's still a difference in the fact that the way in which it scales with the amplitude is still more advantageous in our scheme. So if you look at the comparison between the gate we use here and those other similar approaches I mentioned, when you look at the speed of the gate, this is the same, so it is limited by J. The advantages we have is that, first of all, the gate we use does not require any additional coupler element. So again, and this is a very important point, everything we need to implement the gate is exactly what we need to implement single qubit gates. Then compared to this, to the last generalization of flick four that I mentioned earlier, you actually have you have the situation that the gate can still be relatively fast when you have a driving amplitudes which are not too high. So now looking ahead, we want to address some problems with the present implementation. And the first problem is that due to some design issues, the coherence time in the experiments I've shown to you was not that good. And another thing we want to address is that the coupling between qubits, when you just put qubits next to each other, is of limited range because the qubits have to fill each other in a way to have enough coupling. And the system we are looking at is the following. We want to take two flux qubits and place them in a superconducting resonator. Now, each qubit interacts with the cavity with the resonator of resonance, and as a result, there is an effective coupling term between the two qubits, which is a second-order coupling term, but nevertheless strong enough. So this coupling term has the desired form, sigma x1, sigma x2, and the coupling coefficient is proportional, as I mentioned earlier. It is a second-order type of coupling, so proportional to g1 times g2. This is a device that we use in this experiment. So we have a chip with one superconducting resonator, and we have four qubits coupled to this resonator. Each qubit is addressed individually with a control line. And these are just some pictures of the device we use. So here we have one qubit with this control line, so just a waveguide launcher, and this is the actual first qubit. And we started experiments on this sample fabrication is problematic for a while, but we have the resonators are working properly, and now experiments on qubits are in progress. So now I'd like to close with just a few comments about how general this two-qubit gate is. This type of coupling term between two qubits is actually quite generic. So, and now, okay, I should define things and say that when you have XX, you assume the qubit Hamiltonians to be ZZ, obviously. This shows up for many types of superconducting qubits, and in fact, it is really the case for all circuit QED implementations. So any superconducting qubits in circuit QED would have this coupling term. Recently, this type of gate was used in an experiment on transmon types of qubits. So here the goal was to show coherence properties related to the symmetry of the states, and this the tunability of the gate based on the phase was used in this experiment. Another system where we can use this is one that we explore presently. So this is another project in collaboration with the group of Jonathan Bau at the Institute of Quantum Computing. So what we are trying to do here is take another type of system. So these are single electrons in quantum dots. And you can couple single electrons in quantum dots to a microwave resonator in a way which is very similar to the way in which you couple qubits. And now the coupling, again, has exactly the same form, and you can use the gate I presented to do a CNOT operation on these electron spins. And finally, it's also interesting to think about how this gate would be used in atomic physics. And when we did this work, we put quite a lot of time in searching to see whether this was used before in atomic physics, because it's actually, so when you do anything quantum optics related, it's of course hard to imagine that you do something new when you do this a few decades later than when most things are done. So and we searched in great detail, and we actually didn't find this scheme, and we think the reason for this is that when you think of atomic physics systems, you have the situation that so in our scheme it's essential to control the phase of the applied fields at the location of the two qubits. And when you take atomic systems and when you deal with optical transitions, the phase relation between two parts of your system may be difficult to enforce. So you have this issue that you have to localize the systems within the wavelength in order for this to apply. For the same reason, you also need good position control of your atomic systems. I think this should still be possible if you do excitations which are not based on optical fields, but rather on microwave fields, which is possible too. And in fact, in a recent paper, this possibility was discussed for the case of molecular ensembles coupled to a superconducting resonator. And with this, I would like to close. I'll just put up this summary. So we looked at a new type of two-qubit gate, and we are looking at an experimental implementation which generalizes that initial setting in which we done the experiments. And I would like to thank first of all my collaborators in the DELF group. So as I said, this idea was put together with them, and the experiments were done in Delft for the first implementation. I would like to thank the members of my group. So we have a new group, and they're all working very hard on putting the lab together. And finally, thank you for your attention.